at a very simple level, things are more complex. Organizational systems have more permeable boundaries. It wasn't necessarily like that 30, 40 years ago.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age, from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Curious Advantage podcast. My name is Garrick Jones. I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage. Today, I'm here with my co-author, Paul Ashcroft.
Hello.
And sadly, Simon Brown can't be with us today, but we're delighted to be joined by Viola Rollins. Welcome to The Curious Advantage podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So you're an award-winning organizational psychologist. You've been focused on leadership and psychology for a long time. You're a great leadership educator, and you've been involved with some of the best schools in the UK. Tell us a little bit about leadership and psychology. What is the attraction? Why are they important? And how do they come together?
I think it's a great question. And in some ways, I'm biased, right, in terms of the answer I'm going to give you. But I think classically, it's been very easy to focus on the hard mechanics relating to organization, structure, process, governance. And very early in my career, you know, I was drawn to thinking about, well, there are other things, there are other more critical things that are unseen, but impact on how individuals perform, how they lead, how organizations operate.
Did you train as a psychologist first and then get into organizations, or was it organization first, or which is the chicken, which is the egg?
Actually, I trained as a psychologist. My first degree is in industrial organizational psychology, and then I went on to do my master's in organizational behavior. And it's very interesting. In those days, that kind of profile was rare because there were individuals who had, you know, very different backgrounds to myself. They started out maybe as engineers or IT specialists and found themselves, you know, being drawn to, you know, the more behavioral aspects of working with organizations and what makes them effective.
Yeah, it's amazing because today we take it for granted, don't we, that, you know, behaviorism and psychology is right at the heart of any leadership. And it's funny to think that there was a time when that wasn't part of how we view things. What do you think has been the great contribution of psychology and behaviorism to leadership?
Well, I'm smiling, Garrick, because although we know from a scholarly and a practitioner purview that behavior is not a nice to have, it's a business imperative, there are still organizations out there who, you know, leadership, team effectiveness, it's a nice to have. I think intellectually, yes, many more people may be understanding that culture, behavior, leadership is a critical driver to organizational and business success. But I think people are still challenged in terms of translating that into, okay, what does that mean for myself, my organization, my team on a day-to-day basis? How can I take that theory and that intellectual understanding and make it work for me or access it on a day-to-day basis in a way that it's going to be useful to me?
Viola, one of the things I'm really keen to ask you about is psychological contract, and that psychological contract in the context of leadership, how does that influence the dynamics between leaders and their teams?
So let's just set this up for listeners. So the concept of the psychological contract is a construct that originated in the 1960s, and it was given a contemporary 21st century spin by an organizational scholar called Denise Renoux. And it's defined as the unwritten set of expectations between the employer and the employee at the most basic level. So it touches on aspects of the work experience that contribute to driving motivation, autonomy, engagement with others, et cetera, et cetera. And what I'm seeing in organizations is like, well, we have a multi-generational workforce now. and they want different things and it's difficult to engage them. Or people will be saying, you know, the environment's so complex and fast moving and it's hard to, you know, keep people interested and engaged. And one of the things I feel that's contributing to organizations or those in authority positions or those exercising leadership that's making it difficult is there's not conversations taking place where people are really clear on, actually, you've come into this organization, what's making you want to be here? What would you like to get out of this experience? So this whole notion of the psychological contract has not been redefined in an explicit way. And I think part of that is because many organizations don't know how to respond to people saying, well, you know, I'd like to be doing this. I don't have a lot of experience in doing X, but I want to be leading a huge team. It's like, well, okay, let's talk about that, but let's also get clear on what's required in terms of your experience to allow you to do that effectively in this context. So that's a very long-winded way of saying, you know, I feel organizations aren't having these conversations with people. And I think that's contributing to the millennials, the Gen Zs, the Gen Alphas, mm-hmm. you know, who are now coming into the workforce, and people are just not having the explicit conversations with them. Have a look at my Forbes article. Forbes actually asked me to write an article several years ago on recrafting employees' psychological contract to boost engagement. And I actually give 10 ways that organizations or those who are leading can approach recrafting the psychological contract in a way that's explicit and engaging and 21st century fit, as it be.
I think it sounds very much spot on, and we'll post the link to the Forbes article under the podcast. As you say, it seems the focus is on the employment contract. Here's what you're expected to do. Here's what we're expected to provide for you, not about the psychological contract, as in, why are you here? Sounds like to me, right?
Right.
So much has changed. You know, we got into writing this book about curiosity because we were concerned about the digital and how it was such a narrow bandwidth. And we started off by saying, well, what should we teach the next generation? And that became broader and broader. And we took this multidisciplinary approach and started to get to a point where it was really about curiosity and learning curiosity and thinking that as a superpower. And it also impacted my view of leadership, because you arguably have the lowest individual, the newest member of a team, has as much access to information as the most senior, or people who've been around for a long time, or people who's supposed to be in charge. Everything has changed. I mean, I've had to learn a lot. I've had to almost unlearn my leadership practice in order to work with teams and digital teams and younger teams who expect to be treated in different ways, or even expect to be in social media in very different ways. And that has an impact on organization.
Yeah. Kirk, you've actually picked up on something that's really quite important to me. In fact, I'm very passionate about, and that's about helping people to step back and think about how they're actually defining leadership in the context of the 20th century. And not a lot of people know this, but there's a book out there called The Bass Handbook of Leadership. And one of the things that's featured in this book is the different frames you can use to define leadership. And you notice I've said plural, right? So there's 20 different frames or constructs you can use to think about leadership. Like I said, I'm passionate to get people to think about, not in the context of them necessarily choosing one of those, but to use it as a catalyst to help them think about, what is it that I believe? What are my beliefs about leadership, and what makes effective leadership?
Violet, to come in, it's so relevant particularly at the moment. I was just reflecting, we first spoke a couple of years ago to plan to record together, and through fate and time, we're only just recording this podcast today. And what's happened in between, essentially generative AI and many other things, but that is one of the big things that seems to have really got organizations thinking very meaningfully about what leadership means in their organization. We're seeing a number of companies that are reevaluating from top to bottom what it means to be a leader in their organization and what they need to do to help their leaders grow?
Well, I don't know if this is being prompted by the emergence of generative AI, but one of the trends I am seeing is organizations embracing the notion of leadership as a behavior, as opposed to leadership as a role. Again, I think that is being also prompted by the fact that the organigram is not how the organization works. You know, especially in the 21st century, organizations I describe more like gardens or meadows, where different things are cultivated in different parts. It's organic, it's dynamic. If you sort of agree with that type of framing for thinking about an organization, leadership as a behavior is going to be a more effective way of thinking about leading or cultivating organizational performance.
But this is pretty fundamental, right? Because historically, leadership is a role, is a level, it's a hierarchy, it's something you aspire to, greater levels of leadership. Well, now we're saying, no, lead from your seat. You lead in your role from where you are, and your career may grow in any direction.
Yeah, lead from your seat. Yeah, I'm going to use that one. But let me step back and sort of frame that in a different way. So I was fortunate enough to do some work about 20 years ago with Ron Heifetz, who is currently at the Kennedy School of Government. And he wrote a book I feel is seminal in terms of helping people to really think about leadership and leading, called Leadership on the Line. And there are a couple of distinctions in there that I really encourage organizations to use and think about. One of those constructs is leadership as a behavior, as I've referenced, but he also talks about the fact that there are authority roles that exist within organizations. And those roles are there to provide direction, protection, and order. So if you think about authority roles and leadership as a behavior, I know we can all think into situations where you have somebody who's in an authority role, but they're not exercising leadership. Similarly, we can see individuals who are exercising leadership in organizations, systems, communities, but they're not necessarily in authority roles. It's very interesting when I present those principles to organizations I'm working with, how they start to think differently about, oh yeah, okay. So in the context of that, what might be required for us to cultivate a sense of collective leadership in our organization? And part of that involves letting go of the notion of there's somebody at the top, it's a command and control thing. And that phrase will be familiar to people. But it's more about how can individuals who are maybe in authority roles help orchestrate, facilitate, coordinate the collective leadership capability that exists in their organizations in a way that you can have a better outcome in terms of strategy execution or organizational performance.
You've just provided a really powerful model for me, especially in line with our conversation about how things have changed with all the digital realm that we now inhabit. You're talking about Heifetz and the idea of leaders providing direction, protection, and order, especially in a sort of hierarchical sense, but also in this non-hierarchical world, hyper-connected world, there's also a requirement for direction and protection and order, but that requires a different set of behaviors to enable that to come forward. And then you provide a brilliant set of orchestrate, facilitate, and coordinate. Those are three behaviors that, would you say, underpin the new leadership or underpin the kind of leadership that makes sense in our contemporary world?
Yeah, I'm biased, right, Garrett? So I would say yes, and in some ways, not to be too dogmatic, it's the future, because organizations or ecosystems aren't going to become less complex, right? They're going to become more complex, which is going to require organizations and individuals within organizations to be more dynamic in terms of how they think about doing their work, how they think about coordinating and linking. So yes, I mean, I feel those skills are, I don't want to even say going to become more critical, they are critical. And there are organizations out there who I think are doing that quite well. And we're seeing that in terms of, you know, how they're showing up in terms of performance and how their financials are looking.
And Violet, you mentioned sort of the leaders with authority roles. What about for those, and just back to the point about lead from your seat.
Lead from your seat,
right?
Yeah.
This lovely phrase where everyone is a leader, whatever that means. Have you given some thought to that? If you don't feel you're in a role of authority, but in some way you're expected to lead because my organization is telling me, hey, you're a leader now. Everyone's a leader. What actually does that mean? And what should people do about that? You know, what does that mean in terms of their personal development, you know, where they should focus?
I guess where I would start in trying to answer that is, yes, everybody has an opportunity to be a leader, but it's always important to think about that in context. So yes, I can lead from my seat, but what's the context I need to do that within? What is my team trying to do? What is the individual who, you know, at the top of the team, perhaps in an authority role, trying to do? What is the organization needing to do? So always disciplining oneself to think about the context. What needs to be achieved here? What does good look like? How do we maybe need to align and agree around what good looks like? So there's a context for me to know how I need to show up in terms of exercising leadership.
Yeah. So you're saying it is about really working to understand the context that you're operating from. It seems to be like the primary thing there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not new, right? I mean, the whole leadership frame of situational leadership has been around for years. For years. But I guess I would say I feel that that frame is even more important and critical to think about, especially in the context of 21st century organizations and the challenges that they face both internally and externally.
I'd love to ask you a little bit more about situational leadership. Why do you think that situational leadership or understanding of context is so important these days? I mean, we are biased. We've written a chapter on context. Start with your context and learn the language of the context around you. Because, you know, you can't use the same ideas that got you into a problem to get you out of a problem. If you're going somewhere new, it's a new language. You can't use the same constructs that you bring into a situation to wayfind your way through. So to be open to context. Let's talk about situational leadership. Why do you think it's even more important than before?
Well, Garrick, I think you've stolen my thunder. I don't know, you know, what much more I could add in regard to that. But I mean, for me, it's more important because at a very simple level, and this may be a bit of an oxymoron, at a simple level, things are more complex, right? You know, organizational systems have more permeable boundaries, right? So you may have the formal organization, but also you may have a group of external contributors or joint venture partners or those in freelance roles that help support or drive organizational performance, you know, and that it wasn't necessarily like that 30, 40 years ago. So when you're working in a situation where you have more complexity, more stakeholders, you really do need to think about how do you manage and lead in a way that's more dynamic as opposed to binary.
So, Violo, I wanted to ask you about resilience and leadership and being a leader in today's world in particular at the moment, with the big, big shifts and changes we've seen and we are seeing, it is complex, I think, leading particularly in large organisations. And at a personal level, with the advent of the new technology that people are now working with, is a massive change. What's your advice? What are you noticing with leaders today, particularly related to sort of their own personal resilience?
What I'm observing, what seems to come up in coaching conversations, is the fact that there's just a lot going on. A lot of tasks at the individual level, at the team level, what you're doing in terms of divisions, what's happening in the organizations, what's happening with partner organizations and how you're needing to collaborate with them. And it's easy to sort of feel like you're on a treadmill even more. And it's easy to get swept up into that, right? Like get pulled into the quote unquote machine of doing, I call it, you know, the machine of execution. And what I find with folks who are allowing themselves to get swept into that is they're feeling as if they're having to deal with stuff transactionally. They don't have space to think. Reflection isn't being treated as doing work. You know, thinking about things, that's not acceptable. You have to always be doing.
Being seen to be doing something, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. And what I say to them, you know, is to maintain your sense of energy and resilience, what you need to get better at is managing some boundaries. So, you know, if you can't manage what's coming at you, it's like, how can you create a space for yourself where you can reflect, cogitate, get on the balcony, as Ron Heifetz often says, that's one of his constructs. You know, get off the dance floor, get on the balcony so you can reflect, think about the patterns, get a sense of not only where your head is, but where your heart is in regards to what's going on, in a way that you can formulate a way forward for yourself and those who you work with that makes sense and that is energizing and that isn't draining.
What's the alternative for the sort of machine of doing? And again, what's your advice when you're actually trapped in that and you're in a very performance-oriented organization? You know, I'm just going to get on the balcony. I'm going to spend an hour there. That's fine. I'll be back on the dance floor soon. That isn't culturally seen as acceptable. What have you seen works in terms of shifting some of that?
It's fair to say, Paul, even if it's not felt to be culturally acceptable, it's a business imperative, right? Even if you're somebody who has an extroverted thinking preference, you know, or a task preference, I feel it's important to build up a practice of stepping back and reflecting. So ways that I see people doing that, and again, these will come as no surprise because these have been around for a while, it's blocking that time in your diary. For example, many people I work with, I say, okay, let's start with an experiment. For the next 4 weeks, you're going to block an hour on a Monday or an hour on a Friday, and it's just going to be time to reflect. Don't do your emails. You may do a list of things you want to do or do a mind map, but spend some time reflecting on what you're in, how you feel it's working, what you feel you're doing that's effective, what you feel you could do to be even more effective, requests that you might need to make of your team, of your boss, that you feel are going to make things flow in a way that's more productive or engaging. And I say, you know, start with an hour. In fact, I sometimes say start with 30 minutes at a minimum. And they're like, okay. And then we come back and people are like, oh my gosh, I spent an hour doing this, Violet. And it's been great. It's set me up for the conversations I need to have across the week, for the requests I need to make, you know, up and down the organization. You know, it's created space for me to really think about your challenge to me of, if I'm delegating, what does good look like? Right? Making sure I'm not just in my head about what good looks like and I'm not, you know, sharing that with those who report to me or those I'm collaborating with. So one thing very simple that people I've worked with have said, well, actually, this has really helped change the dynamic of how I'm working. I feel like I'm, you know, one step ahead as opposed to two steps behind because I've created the discipline of making that space.
We're talking to Viola Lejeune-Rollins, who's an award-winning organizational psychologist and has worked as a global strategic organizational effectiveness consultant and facilitator for over 30 years. An American by birth, but based in the UK for her entire career, Viola's area of expertise is in working with organizations to systemically diagnose organizational performance and implement organizational development interventions at individual, group, board, and enterprise levels. And that's a very formal way of saying we're having a fascinating conversation about leadership and what the impact of the digital world that we're inhabiting is having on what it means to be leaders and what that means for us personally in terms of what you were talking about, getting off the dance floor and getting onto the balcony, finding time to reflect and getting just away from the machine of doing. I'd love to ask you, how do you define curiosity and where does curiosity play its role in leadership as behavior?
So for me, curiosity is king or queen. It's critical. And I say that in the context of when you're working in complex environments, being dogmatic, always leading with advocating on your point of view, how it should be, can, you know, often get in the way of engaging with people, aligning, driving things forwards in the way that is required. So I really do believe if people can get better and discipline themselves to start with asking the open questions and be open and receptive to what they hear, it's going to make things easier for them in terms of, again, engaging with others, gaining alignment, driving change. Because by asking questions, you're cultivating data points being generated about a situation, people's points of view, which can then help in terms of driving alignment, creating shared understanding, and getting clear on what good looks like for the collective. So a very simple practice I encourage people to adopt that I'm working with is when you're in a conversation with somebody, force yourself to ask three open questions before you make a statement. And we know what the open questions are, right? Who, what, where, when, how. I get people to try and avoid why. Because why can often have a very, you know, people can feel challenged, right? They feel like they're being interrogated. You know, people often say to me, oh, it's very difficult for me not to say why. And I say, well, here's my challenge. I do believe you can ask the question that you formulated without asking why. All of that is to say, you know, I think if we could be more curious, it would solve a lot of ills in the world. If we could take the time to really understand or want to understand what is driving somebody's point of view on something, what is leading them to interact or act in a certain way and not assume about that, wow, I think we could create more healthy communities, ecosystems, organizations, more quickly than we might imagine.
Now, of course, we're also biased on the Curious Advantage podcast. Being curious is kind of a good thing. But it does strike me listening to you speak there that, you know, back to your, you know, the role of a leader around orchestrating, facilitating, coordinating, you can kind of hack that by being curious, right? Because asking those questions, those open questions that you were just describing and others, and just starting from a point of, I don't have the answer, I'm going to ask some good questions.
Yeah.
You are, yeah, right, facilitating, coordinating, orchestrating the work.
You've got it. Absolutely. And again, we know that the notion of asking questions has been around a while in terms of, you know, the organizational effectiveness genre. Leaders asking questions, teams asking questions. But it is very difficult for many people who are in authority roles to let go of having the answer or feeling like they have to tell.
Yeah. And it leads to, and I wanted to ask you about something, you know, what are you curious about at the moment? But I wanted, in addition to that, say, if you ask questions, you're going to get feedback, right? And I wondered, I think you have some particular views on feedback, and I'm really keen to hear sort of what have you been looking into researching, and just what's your view on feedback? We hear so much about feedback in organizations.
Oh yes, feedback. At the most basic level, one of the things I think about often is the number of feedback models that are out there in the talent management, leadership development, team effectiveness ecosystems that we exist in. And that, of course, come from, 35 years. Ooh, gosh. Yeah, 35 years. 35, 40 years of being out there, working with individuals, teams, and organizations. And it struck me for some reason 18 months ago. It's like, there's a lot of models out there. How might we be able to strip this back in a way that people can build their capability or capacity to give feedback in a way that is maybe affirmational at its base and also is not cognitively overloading? Because again, one of my views on the models that are out there is they're quite cognitive heavy. So when you're practicing them, there's a lot you have to be thinking about, right? Okay, here's the model. When you said this, I did this, it made me feel, and therefore, right? So, when you're sort of building up a capability, that's a lot to be thinking about, even if you have friends you can practice with, which I am a firm believer that, if you're going into a situation where you have to give somebody feedback, that you should prepare. So I don't want to give away too much about my book that I'm writing, but what I'm aiming to do is present a simple two-step process that could be used at the heart of giving feedback, but also is positioned in a way that the feedback conversation is dynamic and it's not binary. Right. So it's not necessarily a manager coming in and saying, okay, I gotta give you some feedback. It's like, well, hold on. Let's give somebody an opportunity to self-assess first and see what they come up with. What do they think they're doing in the context of their role or what they've been asked to do that's effective? And what could they, potentially do to be even more effective?
I'm such a fan. I'm seriously looking forward to your book. And looking forward to speaking with you just on the topic of feedback, because I think we're touching on something that we're going to run out of time from here, because the feedback thing, we think curiosity is really important, and you take feedback from your context, and you take feedback from groups of people, leaders or gatekeepers or people who know stuff and know the language, they can lead you into places, and peers, and you learn your skills, you learn stuff, and you're constantly taking feedback from the world around you. But we've also had conversations where we think a lot of harm can be done when people are just using the term feedback as a mechanism for beating someone up or telling them what they feel or just being nasty, not affirmational at all. Oh, but it's feedback. Well, no, it isn't. And, some feedback has got to be part of a virtuous circle within a system in order for it to achieve the effects you want to be achieved. And the idea that you of yours, which is about creating a simple model that allows us without too much cognitive overload and without too much kind of weird artifice to be able to know what good feedback is in a system is really important, I think, for leadership, for people, and for curiosity. So I can't wait.
Yeah.
I can't wait for your book.
Good.
It's going to be It's going to be great.
Yeah. and there is one thing, Garrick, if I could add,
please,
before we move on, is one of the things I want to focus on in the book is helping people build their capability to give observable behavioral feedback. So avoiding, you know, these phrases like, well, I don't think you did a very good job, or that's really fantastic. You know, it's like, okay, well, in the context of that, what is fantastic? What is it that you saw me doing or saying or how I was interacting that you thought was fantastic or productive? Because again, I think part of the challenge faced with giving effective feedback is people aren't giving behavioral feedback. They're not able to go to the level to talk to people about, here's what I would like to see more of in terms of how you show up or how others engage with you.
Well, I'm going to ask our listeners to hold the space for part two of the Vitalology, because it's going to be fascinating. Yeah. And we've had such a fantastic conversation. We talked about, you know, Bass on leadership, the Hefferty tomes, and the different frameworks of leadership. We've talked about why belief important and self-belief for a leader, and also a lot about the shift in leadership that's happened as a result of the digital sphere and what we inhabit today. And embracing leadership as behavior is a big aha for me. And Heifetz on his leadership on the line, authority. And you talk about these great three things, direction, protection, and order being one of the components of leadership traditionally. But what is required is a sense of orchestration, facilitation, and coordination, which is really useful for us, I think.
And cultivation. I'd add cultivation to that.
And cultivation. And organizations or systems will only need more of this because they're only becoming more complex. And we talked about leading from your seat. And of course, situational leadership in context and how important that is, as well as curiosity. We mentioned permeable boundaries in contemporary organizations and dynamic leadership required because of the change that's happening in organizations, resilience required in today's world, complexity and personal resilience to deal with all the complexity, getting caught up in the machine of doing and managing our boundaries and getting off the dance floor and getting onto the balcony so that there's time to reflect. Talking about curiosity being king or queen, and in complex environments, needing leadership to be curious. The reason being is we need to start by asking the open questions. And you talked about us cultivating data points. That's what the open questions give us, asking who, what, where, when, and how, and resisting asking why, because it doesn't allow the affirmation that's required in sort of great feedback. And letting go as a leader of having the answer. And these, you believe, these small changes in doing things can lead very quickly to healthy ecosystems, which is all part of what we're involved in. I mean, a fascinating, fantastic conversation, Violet. I really look forward to the feedback book that's coming, and we, without doubt, are going to talk to you again. Before we say goodbye to our listeners, what is the one thing you'd like to leave us all with?
I think the one thing I would like to leave listeners with is recognizing that exercising leadership is not about developing a list of things that you need to do to be effective. I feel that if you can focus on one or two practices that you want to develop over a 6 to 8 week period, let's say, and work on those things, I feel confident that you will increase your leadership effectiveness and the impact that you have in your system. Ask those around you, what are one or two things that you think if I focus on in the next 6 to 8 weeks, it would help me become more effective in terms of what I'm trying to do. Pull that together, collate it. Yeah, you can use ChatGPT for that, right? Put the data in, get some themes, and work on those themes for the next 6 to 8 weeks. And I feel confident that at the end of that period, if you go out and you ask people, what have you experienced that's different about me? And has that been helpful, enriching, energizing. I would be surprised if they didn't say, yeah, and here's how it's been helpful. Here's what's made it energizing.
You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast with Viola Rollins. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understanding from neuroscience, anthropology, history, business, behaviorism, art, and science about curiosity and makes these things useful for everyone. We are curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel saying why this was so and what have you learned from it. We are always appreciative hearing our listeners' thoughts and having a curious conversation. Join today, hashtag Curious Advantage. Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your physical, digital, or audiobook copy now to further explore the Senses model for being more curious. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Jessica Wickham.